Hi, this is Andrew Miller from Business Enjoyment, and this is another episode of The Tingle Zone. In this episode, I'm talking with Lane Carker, the real estate anti-guru and ex-engineer who successfully escaped the rat race by building a rental real estate empire. Lane started off following the usual education going into corporate route, but after some saving and investing, found happiness and balance at a lower paying job with thousands of dollars from his passive real estate investments. In our conversation, we discuss matters such as the importance of cash flow over asset appreciation, why you should get as close to your deals as possible, and the scarcity versus abundant mindset. There is even a discussion around whether it's possible or not for everyone to be financially free. Before we jump into the interview, do remember to download a copy of my latest book, More Than Just Money, by going to my website, businessenjoyment.com, where a pop-up should appear. This book runs through the business enjoyment model, shows you how you can use it to find a solution to pretty much any problem, and of course, explains what I really mean when I say that I want you to enjoy your business so much, it makes your bits tingle. So do check that out, but for now, sit back, relax, have a think about where your cash comes from, and most of all, enjoy.
Yeah, so my name is Lane Kawoka. I am the principal of SimplePassiveCashflow.com and real estate operator and podcaster. We currently own 4,500 rental units in the United States, but it all didn't always start off like that. I started investing back in 2009 when I was still working my engineering job, and kind of to give a little context of myself, you know, growing up, I was kind of one of those middle-class kids who parents always taught to go to school, study hard, save your money, be very frugal, and then go into the workforce, buy a house to live in, and work for 40, 50 years and blindly putting your money in all this 401k retirement stuff. And it kind of walked that. I, you know, became an engineer, started working, bought a house to live in. That's what everybody said you're supposed to do, even though I don't quite necessarily agree with that today. And because I was working on the road all the time for my day job, I was never home. So it was kind of silly for this like young 20-something-year-old kid to have this big house to himself. So I just started to rent it out. And the mortgage was $1,600 a month. The rents that brought in was $2,200 a month from the tenants. And yeah, you know, young 20-year-old kid, that was a lot of beer money at the time. And I was like, shoot, if I just keep doing this a few more times, I'll be able to fire my boss, you know, because I didn't really enjoy my engineering job. So that was kind of how it all started.
So your engineering job, because interesting to see you not enjoying that. Was that very much a case of, as you say, follow that path and I've got to do something to keep the parents happy. So I'll do that because I'm okay at whatever I did at school.
Yeah, you know, like maybe I was like good at math and science when I was like 9 or 10, right? So there are societies, I go become an engineer, you know? I mean, that's just, I'm not a huge fan of college education and that type of stuff, but what it did for me is it got me a good paying job. And real estate investing, you need money to invest. If not, there's all this realm of house flipping, wholesaling. I don't do any of that, right? My URL is simple passive cash flow. If you don't got no money, you can't passively invest, right? And there's a myriad of very cumbersome and high risk strategies where you can invest with no money. I don't do any of that. I go after cash flow. So buying properties that are cash flow positive on a monthly basis, so the rents more than exceed the repairs, maintenance, third party property management, because we don't want to be screwing around with tenants and repairs ourselves as the investors, and then enough money for CapEx that they can see and other mishaps. So we follow this rule called the 1% rent to value ratio rule. So you find the rent to value ratio by taking the monthly purchase price or the monthly rents that brings in divided by the purchase price. So we're looking for something 1% or higher. So a lot of places we'll have our students go after and buy is like $100,000 turnkey rental that'll rent for around $1,000 a month. So 1,000 divided by 100 grand is 1%. Most places people live in, it just won't work. The numbers won't work. You know, like a $400,000 piece of junk in California in the ghetto, where you don't buy properties in the ghetto, by the way, might rent for $2,000 a month. So 2,000 divided 400 grand is 0.5%, that ain't gonna work. So that's kind of like the what we target from a numbers perspective.
Is that a number that you sort of got to yourself, or is this sort of a considered opinion you picked up over the time?
It's considered an opinion. I mean, I think there's kind of two camps in the real estate world. I mean, if you exclude all that noise of the house flipping, wholesaling, I mean, that's just noise to me. But, you know, most people will still invest for appreciation, right? Buy low, sell high. It kind of makes sense. But prices of homes never really go up all the time, right? It kind of goes up cyclically. So how do you mitigate yourself? As Warren Buffett says, you know, the rule number one of investing is don't lose money. How do you ensure that? Well, what you do is you go into properties that cash flow, right? On a month-to-month basis. Sure, you might have a big repair here or there, or a tenant might move out. But by having that cash flow there, you kind of smooth it out and you make a steady gain every single year. Irregardless if the economy goes up or down or your price of your property goes up and down.
Yeah, it's the long-term yield rather than you're not investing for capital growth. It's the, as you say, it's generating cash as you go along.
So I mean, a lot of people will buy properties for capital growth. I just call that gambling, right? I mean, easy come, easy go. If you're not in there rehabbing units, forcing appreciation of the property and commercial properties, which we do today in our apartments, I mean, you're quite frankly just getting lucky.
Yeah.
I don't like luck. But then again, it is freaking real estate, and real estate does typically go up in price, right?
Yeah.
But you know, let's call it what it is, luck. Like Dogecoin, right?
So you kind of got into it effectively by accident. Circumstances sort of led it you to start making the what felt like an obvious decision. And as you say, then you sort of thought, okay, I can do more of this. So how did you sort of then step forward from your first one? Did you just go and just do it, or did you start researching and learning from other people and sort of following some standard recommendations that others are doing? How did you start building your empire?
Yeah. I mean, the first couple of weeks, it was like, wow, this is cool, right? I got all this money to blow. And then I started to think, this could be my ticket out of this rat race. And that is like exactly like you said, that's when I got a little more sophisticated, started to listen to podcasts, started to learn about the 50% rule, the 1% ratio, like I just mentioned. Get a little more sophisticated around this stuff, right? And, you know, just, I got really motivated, right? Because this is my ticket out of the rat race, like I said.
I mean, were you, as you mentioned, with the rat race and the engineering job, were you actively hating it, or was it really just a case of...
I think somewhere in between the middle. I mean, you know, as a younger engineer, any young professional, your job sucks, right? Maybe you're not getting coffee for everybody, right? I mean, they don't make college grads do that anymore, thank goodness. But you're not doing the most, you know, coolest stuff. And I mean, I was traveling a lot. It was working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. I mean, heck, I was never home, right? I was out in the field managing blue collar construction staff, union-based staff. It wasn't the funnest of times. I learned a lot, you know, leadership-wise, management-wise, but I mean, it was not a happy, you know, peak of my career, you know? It wasn't like that. I was at the bottom. So there was a lot of motivation there at the time. So, you know, this is where like the motivation to find different ways to get out of this situation came about. But the one nice thing I will say is like, you know, I made pretty close to six figures right out of college. And I was really frugal. I have a section on my website where, you know, I used to do all these like really cheapo things, like to save money. SimplePassiveCashflow.com/cheapo if people want to get a chuckle there. But I was able to save maybe $50,000 to $80,000 a year. Part of the reason was, you know, once I started to rent out my house, I didn't live anywhere. I didn't have a rent payment. I didn't have a mortgage payment. I just lived on the company dollar for a few years there. And all that money went into buying rental properties. As soon as I saved up 30 grand, I was buying another property, $100,000. Here in America, it's 20% down payment. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, government subsidized debt. It's the golden tickets until you use them all up. Which now you can get, I think, 10 in your name, 10 in your spouse's name, 10 homes in your name, 10 houses. So that was, And I just kept on buying the next property. It took me a couple years to save up to buy another one. And then I realized that I had started buying in Seattle, Washington, where the rental value ratios aren't that great. It's more of an appreciation market. So I started to look into other markets such as Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis. Not the sexy places, but better cash flow. So I bought one property there, and then I sold the Seattle rentals. And in 2015, I had 11 rental properties, four in Birmingham, five in Atlanta, one in Pennsylvania, one in Indianapolis.
How are you managing the properties? Were you right from the bat, just saying, right, I'm buying it, push it out to somebody who looks after all the tenancy and the managing of it and move on? Or are you getting hands-on and...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I hired third-party property management, number one, because I could. The property's cash flow and could support paying that property manager 10% of the rents. This is probably one of the biggest mistakes mom-and-pop investors make. They do it all themselves, right? They're the ones out there driving Mercedes out to clean the toilet. Right? They be the investor, not the freaking landlord.
They have, right? Better margins, and they can afford a better Mercedes, but the job that they're doing is, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. My biggest thing, and what I teach my students, is like, what is your highest and best use? For a lot of my doctors, lawyers, engineers, dentist clients, it's going in there, be a doctor, lawyer, dentist, engineer, certainly not being a landlord, right? Mm. And the biggest bang for their buck can be saving their money to buy more assets, right? Certainly not playing property manager or flipping houses or wholesaling houses, right? That's a job. Mm. And I get it. Like, most people in this world do not make six figures and above. And that is why they have to wholesale houses, flip houses, or doing these other actions, these more active real estate activities that are not passive. But yeah, it's after that, you know, it just takes time, right? I bought my first rental property in 2009. Then in 2015, I had 11. And then I started to feel the crunch a little bit. You know, with 11 rental properties, I had maybe an eviction or two every year, some kind of big issue that happened every quarter, like a tree fall in the house or a rainstorm kind of flooded a piece of the property. Not a big deal, because the property managers kind of take care of the boots in the ground. They get the repairs all lined up. They kind of appease the tenants. But, you know, with 10 rentals at a few hundred dollars of cash flow each, that's what, $20,000 to $30,000 of passive income a year. Not bad, right? For some people, that might be half of their salary. But I don't know what American can survive off $20,000 to $30,000 of passive income a year. Most that I talk to need triple that. So you're gonna need 30 houses, and now triple all that exceptions, right? Now you're talking an eviction every other month and some kind of big catastrophe that happens every other week. So it's just not scalable. And this is when I went searching for that next thing, right? What are other accredited high net worth investors doing to do all, like, what are they doing? They're not buying rental properties, right? Maybe they did to start out. And that's, I still think people should, if their net worth is under $250,000, $500,000, go buy some rental properties. But what do they do when your net worth rises, looking more for scale? And this is where I found the world of private placements and syndications, where private investors will go in as LP investors into much larger deals ran by professional operators. And the limited partners, the LPs, are not managing members. Therefore, it's little to no liability. They don't get any debt in their name. The general partners put the debt in their name. And now they get to diversify into different projects scattered throughout, you know, different geographic areas, different business plans. I mean, it's the dream, right, to be a passive investor in these country club deals.
So I'm going to actually go through that again a bit slower, because I think some of the terminology you use may not exist in England, sort of thing. So I'm
sure
what you're talking about, but maybe it's me. But either way, so the more scalable model. Just talk through that again.
So instead of just going around buying property after property after property, right, which I think is still a great place for people to start.
Yep.
And for those people, I would suggest checking out my info page on rental properties at simplepassivecashflow.com/turnkey. There are turnkey rentals out there that people can buy. I don't sell them, but this is how I started. You know, great way to get started. But what do you do when you're a higher net worth investor looking more for scale?
Yep.
Well, there are things called, and I think people call these kind of the country club deals, right? These are the deals that used to be swapped around at the country club. Now nobody really golfs anymore. Nobody has the time for that and schmoozing at the country club. But these deals still exist. where a syndicate comes together, pulls together capital, and goes and buys a much larger asset.
So it might, that is, might be a commercial property. It might be a large residential site.
You know? Right. I mean, it could be anything, right? I mean, it could be a bunch of people pull some money together, go buy a brewery.
Yeah.
Make a donut shop, a multifamily apartment, a huge multifamily apartment complex, or maybe even a ground up development. You can raise capital and syndicate anything.
Yeah. So
the key here is it's more of like a co-op.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas traditional investments in Wall Street, or I don't know what you guys call it, but those are more retail investments. And that's ultimately what hurts the average folks out there. There's just so many middlemen in there taking all the fees, all these hidden returns for them. And that's ultimately what's hurting people. I mean, going back to like my early days, when I was investing in just a simple rental property, I was making like 20, 30% plus returns on my money. People don't believe me. They can go to my whiteboard video where I kind of go through the math at simplepassivecashflow.com/returns. But just go with me for this. Like early on, I was like, I'm making like 20, 30% of my money. Why the heck would I want to put my money in this 8 to 10% nonsense, right? And then I realized this whole system is engineered to get everybody into these fee-laden products. I mean, how else do they have all these Wall Street high executive salaries and these big buildings? They're not doing it for free, you know? And it's all this big scam to kind of get everybody, like a bunch of cattle, to go through these retail products. It's no different than buying a pair of Nikes at what are some high-end retailers? Like here in America, it's like Neiman Marcus or Nordstrom. I don't buy Nikes at those places because it's going to be more freaking expensive, right? I might go buy it on eBay or Amazon or heavens, maybe even Macy's. But I'm not going to go pay to that high end. And that's effectively what everybody's doing when they have their hard-earned retirement money and they're putting into these fee-laden products. And that's what frustrates me a lot.
It's sort of like a pyramid scheme slash network marketing scheme type thing where the end user pays so much more for the product so that all the people above can get their cut, isn't it?
Right, right. And yeah, it may, I don't know what preceded one or the other, but I mean, they have financial planners. Financial planners don't know what they're doing, right? They just get paid off the commissions of the products that they sell to investors.
Depends on the financial planner, of course, but
I don't know what financial planner doesn't do that, right? I mean, how would they not? I mean, supposedly there's the fiduciary responsibility rule, but I mean, really, I stopped believing in the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, and the Tooth Fairy a long time ago.
And that's it. And so the closer you can get to the actual deal in and of itself, and of course, you know, if you're in that consortium, you've got more power, I guess is probably the right word.
Right. The difference between going like retail, where the average guy is getting slaughtered with fees, and then doing it yourself, right? Buying your own rental property on your own. But for people to get to a certain level, there has to be more of a wholesale method in the middle, right? Where you're not doing anything. You're not the one dealing with all the little repairs, managing the manager, but you're still like, you've kind of cleaned out all the middlemen, right? And that's where this kind of crowdfunding phenomenon and these private placements and syndications come into play. But it requires a little bit of networking, right? You have to build relationships with other pure passive investors, because who do you trust, right? You don't know. I didn't know when I first started. I didn't have a network of people who did this stuff. I knew a heck of a lot of people who were brainwashed into investing in Wall Street products at work, right? But that's certainly not the people who I want to listen to for financial advice. Cliff and Larry, who works in the cubicle next door, are not the people that I want to be listening to. And it's definitely not my parents, right? Those are some of the worst people to get financial advice from.
Unless you're lucky. But yeah, in general, the mindset has shifted quite dramatically over the last 50 years, isn't it, in terms of how you run things. And how do you build that trust?
Well, you add value to people, right? I mean, and you find the right people. I think finding the right people is the hardest thing, right? You're trying to find other accredited investors better investing in these types of things. Also,
that's what I mean, you know, find the right person is about building that, knowing, as you said, I'm not going to rely on that person. You've got to find the right people, you've got to network, so you're starting to make the contacts, you can build, get them to trust in you because you can add value. But how are you filtering out the right people? Is it just over time they're making common sense, they're saying sensible things, or are you seeing the results coming through, or what's the...
Yeah, exactly. And I think the biggest barrier is to getting in the right rooms, right? I mean, there are a lot of local real estate clubs, but it's just filled with house flippers and guys with no money.
Yeah.
You know, as passive, high paid professionals, those kind of groups just, you know, this is not what we're doing. A lot of us are buying properties remotely and hands off. Right, there's a lot of free internet forums, but it's mostly filled with more active investors, right? Not passive investors that are kind of doing it the way we are.
So it takes a bit of time for you to for one to understand what it is they're looking for and who the right sort of people are. Because if you just go in first time into that room, you don't really understand the game or who the right people to speak to are, but over time you start filtering out the rights and the wrongs for what it is.
Right. And this is why we kind of, to try and make it easy for people, we've created the free week group, which I call is mostly passive higher net worth investors, right? So at least you're in the right room. But this is the tricky part, right? And I think this is why passive investing is not for everybody. You have to play nice. You got to be a fun guy, you know, like you can't just be a jerk, right? Why would anybody want to help you or build a relationship if you're somebody like that?
Yeah, it's a long-term strategy. If you go in to get a quick win, you'll be up once, but never again.
Right, exactly.
What's going to do? What intrigues me, or intrigues to know, is when you've, going back to when you're talking about, okay, I'm in this job, here's something that can get me out of the rat race. At that point, what did being outside of the rat race mean to you, and how has that changed over time?
Well, I've kind of switched from one hamster wheel to another, right? Like I've kind of gone down this path of putting together real estate opportunities, and I've turned it into my new profession, right? So I've never really gotten out. I've just traded one rat race for another, essentially. But there was a point in there where I was financially free, and I realized a point where, I mean, I think for a couple of weeks there, I was kind of like, well, this is kind of fun, right? I don't need to work anymore. And I think you see a lot of personal finance bloggers go on this path where they're just going to go travel abroad for a couple of years. For me, it was a lot quicker than that. It was just maybe a couple of weeks where I was like, yeah, this is kind of lame. Right, taking pictures of my food and posting it on Instagram. It's kind of lame, right? There has to be more to this than just drinking pina coladas with endless time on my hands. And that's kind of where like this mission came in. And you know, when people have different missions, right? And when I implore people and I help some people trying to find their mission, it's usually what pisses you off in life, or at least that's for me, right? For some people, it's, you know, battered women, right? They want to help them out, or homeless dogs, or, you know, for me, it's just like, there's so many hardworking professionals out there that work so hard and did everything that they were supposed to do, right? Pay their taxes, buy their house to live in, which I don't necessarily agree with. And especially invest in all these mainstream, you know, retail Wall Street products, where ultimately their returns were just stolen from them. This is the wrong that I want to correct. And if people just bought a handful of rental properties and kind of just pressed on with that route, they'd be financially free in probably 5 to 10 years. And not hope and pray in 40 and 50 like the traditional method. It is simple, but it's very counterintuitive what the wealthy do compared to what normal people do. But it's not that hard. And I think that's why I've tried to create simplepassivecashflow.com in such a way to distill what the wealthy do, show the paradigms on why you would do it and when you would do it, and then kind of put it out in a simple manner that the layperson that can understand.
And is your your club, your teachings purely around property, or are you looking at other various sort of passive, and obviously there's the industry side of the country house club things as well, which goes a little bit beyond property, but as a general rule, is it in that sort of space, or are you going to all sorts of?
Yeah, I mean, I started with like investing in stocks and real estate first, but the reason I keep coming back to real estate are kind of three big things. Like, first, real estate is a hard real asset. It doesn't just bounce up and down like paper stocks, right? It's a commodity, right? The brick, the wood, the land. It's a real asset that sort of acts like a commodity. The second thing is like it cash flows, right? Cryptocurrency doesn't really cash flow. Stocks don't really cash flow, right? Cash flow is what puts food on the table. And that's what real estate does, especially when you go after 1% rent to value ratio properties are better. But, I mean, and the last one is like the tax benefits. I mean, someone needs to make 3 or 4 times as more than me in crypto and keep the same amount of money at the end of it than I do with real estate because of the great tax benefits. And this is where, you know, you start to get insight into how the wealthy do things. Yeah, they invest in better assets, better deals. But when these deals, they can do cost segregations to pull all these passive losses out of the investment and use these passive losses to choose how much taxes they would like to pay. And that's when you start to realize, wow, this is a kind of a twofold kind of strategy here, the whole tax game.
Mm. Yeah. And going back to the your shift in terms of, you know, getting to that point of financial free, couple of weeks going bored, realizing what your mission was, the thing that pissed you off, and then now getting driving forward from there. How is it different from having a mission-based business that you've got now compared to where it was before? How do you feel about what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, when I started my podcast back in 2016, it was just a means for me to. A lot of my friends were asking me, well, how are you buying all these properties that you don't even visit that are like a couple thousand miles away? You know, when I was buying these turnkey rentals in Birmingham, Atlanta. And, you know, I would explain to my friends over lunch how I would do it. And of course, nobody does anything, you know, friends. So I started to make the podcast, right, as a way to record the damn thing. So I would have to keep repeating myself. And that was how it started. But then throughout the years, as I became more of an accredited investor, the topic materials has changed to more private placements and syndications, taxes, legal, and legacy creation. And that was kind of where I started to grasp hold upon the mission, right? The mission is to kind of help working professionals out there learn and see the differences between mainstream financial advice that is put out there and what are the real wealthy people doing. And to kind of distill that and into actionable steps for regular people. We're really good, hardworking people. I mean, it's the shrinking middle class, right? Those are they're kind of endangered species, and that's kind of the target.
Hmm. So how has your relationship changed with your business now that it's more mission focused?
I mean, I think it helps figure out, like, you know, every day you're making binary decisions. Should I use this color or that color? Should I send out this email or that email? Should I put this in my funnel sequence or not? It just kind of clarifies everything, right? Like, what's the mission? Well, the mission is to help out, you know, that one dude out there, Andrew, right? He's struggling. He's struggling to get by. He's, you know, a good saver of his money, right? He's not financially irresponsible, but he's just not seeing, he's not getting any traction. Seems like he's always, you know, he's saving up his money, but it's very slow, and he's paying a lot of taxes in the time. What does Andrew want, right? What color would I use here that would speak to Andrew more? I mean, I know that's a little weird, but, like, you know, what can I write in this one paragraph here that will resonate with Andrew or have him understand it, right? And I think a lot of this is like, that's where simple passive cash flow, the simple part, came in. There's all this noise out there, right? There's so much stuff out there.
Mm.
And the truth is, what the wealthy do is very simple, right? But the trouble is, like, getting rid of all this noise for Andrew to understand, all right, what does he do next? Because this is all new to him, right? And there's a lot of noise out there, right? There's all these lawyers selling this entity, that entity. There's all these CPAs selling this strategy or that strategy. You hear infinite banking, this, that, you know, like, what is the path? What is the order to implement these strategies, right? What is the simple prescription?
So it just it gives you clarity at the end of the day, isn't it? That's the word that's coming through for me there. It's just, it makes your life a lot easier when you know what it is you're doing.
Right. People are strung out. I mean, they're working their butts off, especially the people in my group, right? They're high paid working professionals, high responsibility. They just want to be told what to do for some of this stuff, right? Just like when I go into the CrossFit gym, I want to just turn off my brain. I'm just like, tell me what to do. I'm running 100 miles an hour all day in my business. And I'm sure everybody feels the same way at the professional occupations. Just tell me what to do, right? I'll listen and I'll drive 100 miles per hour, but just tell me what direction to do. Mm. And then the hard thing is in this financial world, there's a lot of bad habits that we've been taught by our parents, by society. And the real secret sauce is implementing this stuff, right? Like, so take one thing like infinite banking, using whole life insurance. And I think we've all heard how bad whole life insurance is for you. Not the case if you tweak it a certain way, the way the wealthy do it, but also implement it at the right point in your timeline, in your journey, right? It is a huge component of a wealth building strategy for the high net worth.
Mm.
But we've been all kind of brainwashed by all these, you know, these kind of like generalities, right? About certain things.
Mm. And it's ironic, isn't it, that as you say, those people in the corporate world are absolutely best placed to leverage things up and make the best use of these skills. They just don't know them.
Right. But it is ironic, but then it is not, because if everybody did what I said to do, buy a handful of rentals, right, get out of these fee-laden products, invest tax-advantaged ways, most people are able to leave the rat race in 5 to 10 years. Who would get our coffee, right? Who would build our bridges? Who would design the bridges? Who would push the government paper? Who would do surgeries? Who would clean our teeth? Society would likely crumble. Like, we can't have this happen, right? Not everybody can be financially free.
Who should be them?
Those who are worthy, that are going to hopefully take the information and do something greater with it. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just, this is a political statement, but like, I honestly don't think that you take 10 or you take 100 people, you turn them financially free, I'd say a majority would probably just go and travel abroad and take Instagram pictures of their food that they're eating,
yeah.
Right? But maybe that small minority that do get financially free will find that resonance frequency in the thing that their highest and best use, that their God-given talent that they're put on earth to do, and they would make a bigger impact than the other 95% of the people that were financially free. That's just me being optimistic.
Well, I think it's a fair reflection on the variety of humankind, isn't it? And that's the truth of it, isn't it? And being fairly flippant in that question, but it's true. There's that moralistic element of when we push things in a certain direction, what if everybody were to do that? But the truth is exactly as you say, it's just never going to happen because we've got a wide variety of people.
Yeah. I mean, they do this in China, right? That's effectively what communism is, right? They give everybody that bare minimum, right? They don't have to really work for it. But what do people typically do? They just watch Netflix to chill, right?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it's a theory. In a theory, it works. But in real life, I think from my point of view, it doesn't work.
Yeah. And you know, that's that small 1% or whatever you said, the way they're actually then leveraging that freedom or financial freedom to really use their gifts for the betterment of mankind. Do you get to see that with some people? Do you get to work with people in that space?
Yeah, we have a higher level mastermind. We call it the Family Office Ohana Group. The goal of that is to get people from $1 million over $10 million net worth. And the first threshold is getting people to that $4.5 million mark. That is a mark that a lot of people in our world we talk about, right? Because at that point, $4 or $5 million net worth, you're able to pass down a substantial amount of money to your kids, and they can really, really try hard to screw it up, and it's really hard for them to do that, right? $1 million, $2 million is nothing today, right? That'll be gone in a generation, easily. In fact, I think the statistics are like 90% of money is lost in 2 to 3 generations. Guarantees, it's gone. But if you can get up to that $4.5 million mark, you're set. And something happens along that way. There's a phenomenon of like, when you get on an airplane, they always say, well, if there's any problems, put your own oxygen mask on first, then help out your kid, right? Same thing here. There's a point where people are trying to put on their own oxygen mask, which makes sense. It's not selfish, right? Some people call this the scarcity mentality, right? And I don't really call it like to say you're selfish, right? But yeah, you got to get yourself to a good place first. Be safe first. And then that's what I call that is getting yourself to $4 or $5 million net worth. After that point, hopefully your mindset you're in a good place and your mindset starts to free up and you start to transition from scarcity to abundance mindset when you start to kind of look around and send the elevator back down for others, help out others, figure out what is your highest and best use and kind of help the world. Make a world a little bit better place in your unique talent, in your way. Not everybody who I get from 4 million and go up, you know, kind of take that next step to make a platform and kind of create better good in the world. It's a minority. But if they never got past that, never put their oxygen mask on in the first place, they would have never done it after that.
Yeah, it's the old phrase is that gets misrepresented is it's better to give than receive, and people interpret it incorrectly. And I think it was Francis of Assisi that it actually comes from, and the original quote is actually what you've just said: it's better to be in a position to be able to give than to be in a position where you have to receive. So it's exactly that: get yourself up to a point where you are then able to help other people up.
Exactly. You know, money is not everything, but it sure makes life a lot easier, and it gives you options. And money is also a magnifier, right? If you're a good person, it makes you better. If you're selfish and only thinks for yourself, well, you'll turn into that more, right? So it magnifies who you are.
I'm interested in that point because it's something here. Have you seen that in reality? Is that something you've witnessed?
Heck yeah. A lot of people come into my group are very frugal, right? They're first generation immigrants, right? A lot of them are Asian. They're cheap. They're super cheap, right? And that's good, I think, when you're starting out, right? That immigrant mentality, right? You're not spending money in stupid things. And that's how you grow. That's how you grow that initial capital to invest, right? But at some certain threshold, that really holds you back. And it holds you back in terms of building relationships with other key partnerships. And maybe you're not doing business with each other, but you're getting, you're trading knowledge, right? And that scarcity really holds people back is what I see. And it shows up in very small ways, but I think people inherently, they feel, they know, you kind of know what I'm talking about when you just kind of feel it, right? When somebody is like that, when they're more that scarcity mentality, they're just a little cheap, or, you know, they're just not free, I guess, right? They're not a magnetic personality, right? For the guy who's just fun loving, buying drinks at the bar for everybody. You're not saying you have to buy drinks at the bar for everybody, right? But metaphorically, right, in that setting, that's what that person would be doing in other non-alcoholic situations.
Yeah.
No. There are some people where energy, you know, they kind of help out other people and it's free. It's free flowing. There's other people where energy stops with them, right? And they kind of think about themselves only, right? I mean, you've got a podcast, you've got a platform. You wouldn't be doing it unless, you know, you feel like the world is energy flows with us. But there's a lot of people listening right now that are, I'm not saying that you're bad people out there, but maybe think about people in your network. There are people out there that the energy kind of stops, right? They just kind of think about themselves, and not saying that they're bad people, but what I'm saying is like, maybe we have to get their oxygen mask on first. We have to make them feel comfortable, not, you know, get them financially abundant thinking so that they do feel safe to then bust out and then become more free giving, abundant mindset. Right? It's not that they're bad people, but the situation, the environment has created that type of personality.
And I think the key thing that you said there is in there is that whatever mindset anybody has, it has a value for the right context. So that frugality you said, it was really useful, right, to start off with at the beginning, but then the context shifts and moves. So it's really common at all levels of entrepreneurs, whatever it is that the mindset that's got somebody to a certain point is then the mindset that holds them back from getting to the next level. I think there's a whole book on it by Marshall Goldsmith, actually. What got you here won't get you there. And so the mindset has to keep continually shifting to move forward.
Right. It's moving from starting strategy to mid-game strategy and maybe end-game strategy.
Like going through the gears, bikes.
First generation, most of the people in our community are first generation wealth. We weren't born with $1 million. Our parents didn't have money, right? So we come into this with a lot of baggage, right? This frugality mindset. And that's great, right? Because, you know, we save our money, we grow our net worth, and we become first generation wealth. And how I define that is the first generation to hit, I don't know, some arbitrary number, like $1 million net worth, right? That's pretty decent, right? But how do you take it from $1 million to $10 million? Well, there needs to be a transformation, right? Kind of going through that next stage of becoming, and how do you groom G2 wealth? That's the next stage.
And what do you do for your own mindset? How do you keep expanding your headspace?
Well, I mean, I'm a conscious of this. I'm aware of this. I don't have everything all figured out, right? But what I do know is magical things happen when you have people of like-minded that are similar on the path as you around you in close vicinity. And that's kind of what a mastermind group does, and kind of, you know, it keeps you those type of people around.
Yeah, no, exactly. And presumably everyone's at a slightly different level or different perspective, so everyone brings their own dynamic, and no one's exactly the same blueprint, so it's not like you're just regurgitating the same stuff. There's always a new spark coming off from somewhere.
Right. But the problem is, at least, you know, filling the room up with people who aren't broke, right? And I consider broke under $1 million. Yeah, you might make six figures, but you're broke. If your net worth is not, you know, well above $1 million, you're still trading time for money. And there's a difference between people who trade time for money and people who have their money working harder, making more money for them, right? There's a difference. And the metaphorically, that difference could be that person has their oxygen mask on and the other person is comfortable enough to take it off and not give that oxygen mask to others, right? But the trouble is, well, how do you find people like this? Because high achievers that have kind of reached this scale on their own, not by being a trust fund kid, they're hard to find. And they don't wear wear different clothes. They don't have different color hair, right? Yeah, they may tend to hang out in different places, but it's very difficult to determine those people who are up to the stage and just happen to finance a nice house or finance a nice car, buy everything on debt. Right, it's very difficult. And these are some of the kind of the more soft topics that we discuss in our mastermind within closed doors, right, in a safe environment. And I think I would encourage everybody out there to kind of find your little group, right, of like-minded people that are also thinking about this stuff. Because the informal groups with Cliff and Larry at the office, who've got it all wrong, right, those aren't going to help. That's just going to hold you back. Your network is your net worth, as we say.
Perfect. Before we wrap up, is there any final thing you'd like to sort of, any key message you want to get across over and above what you've already said? I mean, obviously the key thing is coming through nice and clear that, you know, you've got to get your money to work for you and get the mindset of shifting away from what have been the old traditional ways of thinking and start thinking about how to make it work properly. But any sort of key things that you would like to get across?
Surround yourself with the right people and just start educating, right? Depending where you are in the journey, you know, it might just be buying your first rental property if you're under $500,000 net worth. That's how I started, and it just takes a while. It is not a get rich quick thing. I bought my first rental property when I had no net worth, just out of college in 2009. It took me damn near 6-7 years to get up to 11 rental properties. Right. If you're more of an accredited investor, check out our content at simplepassivecashflow.com/syndication to kind of learn more there. But yeah, you know, just if this interests you guys, you know, please reach out.
And as you say, the you know, that main line there of getting yourself in a good position, all that does is enable you to help more people if that's what's important to you. So it's not about in and of itself earning the money. That enables you to do other things from there, isn't it?
Right. And if you're not going to, if the helping other people doesn't come naturally to you, that's cool. You're not a horrible person. You know, I wasn't like that. I was kind of just pretty selfish and just thinking about myself. Right. So this is nothing. I mean, we don't want to shame anybody.
We over time, we've got different needs. And when we first start out, then actually, you know, we've got to be looking after ourselves. But when you get to that position, your view shifted because you got to the point where you realized, actually, the reason I started out in the first place, I've done that. I've achieved it. And now I need something else. There's something else that needs to come from it. And then you've turned it into a way that, you're still benefiting out from it. No one's saying that's not happening. But ultimately, it's a drive to educate more people and get other people to come up. And it completely, and as we go through our own journey, these sort of our requirements shift and change in what becomes important to us.
Yeah, I think one theme is like, well, I think you got to figure out what is your highest and best use to help other people. I think that's a pretty consistent theme once you get to, you know, certain levels. The question is what it is, right? Like for me, it's finances, money, investing. Other people might be a gym trainer, right? They enjoy doing that. That's their God-given talent. Mm. Other people might just be, you know, you're really good doing at knee surgeries, you know, it's just cool, right? Whatever you want to do, you know, I think you find some way to kind of connect it to kind of helping people in their darkest of days. I think that's where a lot of people find true fulfillment.
Yeah. Yeah. And so final question, which I ask everybody on these podcasts, and you're no exception. You don't get away from it. So, it kind of touches in on that, Lane. What is it that makes your bits tingle?
I just see a lot of hardworking people out there kind of doing it the wrong way, right? They're driving around in the Ferrari with the handbrake on. They're doing all these things that kind of just hold them back. Buying a house before their net worth hits $1 million to live in. I don't really agree with that. Investing in retail type of products. In non-tax advantage things, right? There's just a lot of people pay a lot of taxes and they don't really need to legally. But if they just educated themselves a little bit, right? You don't need to spend all your time doing this stuff to kind of relearn things. There's a lot of people that have kind of forged a path and found the simple passive cash flow way.
Excellent. Thank you, Lane. So if people need to find out more, your website is simplepassivecashflow.com. There's a huge amount of information on there and readily available, as you alluded to. Is there anywhere else that people need to go to track you down, find out more about you?
If people are podcast listeners, which I think they are, check out Simple Passive Cashflow, Passive Investing on iTunes, Google Play, etc. Then my email is lane@simplepassivecashflow.com.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you, Lane. It's been really, really informative to have you on. And those old school thoughts about how money works for us are shown time and time again to be not serving us well. And so I would recommend everybody to jump on to your website, and if it's new to you, start learning some basics. If you're already sort of along the way, there's so much that you've got that people can take away from. So thank you so much for coming on board and giving some really good useful information.
Yeah. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Lane. These podcasts are not necessarily here to give you all the answers. I want you to think about what's been said, what's come up, and how you might apply that to your own situation. And if you've enjoyed it, then please subscribe to the podcast and, of course, share it on the social media platforms. And so more people get a chance to hear what's going on. Thanks very much for listening. My name's Andrew Miller from Business Enjoyment, and I want you to enjoy your business so much it makes your bits tingle.